So I'm happy to welcome Jacques Viennard at our Quantum Foundations seminar. He will be talking to us about relativistic relational quantum mechanics and cubism. So please.
All right. Let me share a screen. All right, everyone sees the screen? Say no if you don't. All right, so can you see my cursor also? Great.
Yes.
Yes.
All right, yeah, so as Philippe said, I'm Jacques. I'm based at the Cubism Group at UMass Boston with Chris Fuchs et al. And yeah, this talk is about cubism and relational quantum mechanics, but in a fairly abstract way. Those of you who are expecting a breakdown of the recent papers that I wrote about this and Rovelli's reply may be disappointed because I'm actually a very bad person who doesn't like to talk about research that I just did. I'd like to talk about the research that I'm about to do and haven't finished yet. So, but I will say a few things about this. So let's dive in. Cubism and relational quantum mechanics are interpretations of quantum mechanics, and they're both special, notable, I would say, for saying that facts are relative to observers. That's kind of the main, I think, the main radical step that they both take. And I wrote a couple of papers, one of them criticizing relational quantum mechanics and the other comparing cubism to RQM. And Rovelli and Andrea just wrote a reply to that, which I urge you to check out. But something that is conspicuously absent from those papers is any discussion of locality. And there's a reason for that, which I hope will become clear throughout the duration of this talk. But basically, it boils down to it's really hard to define locality when your ontology says that facts are relative to observers. That's the bottom line. And in this talk, I'm going to try and do exactly that. I don't know if I'll succeed, but I'm just going to dive in and give it my best shot for your entertainment. So I'm going to try to argue two main points. Number one, if space-time is treated as kind of an effectively classical backdrop to all of our quantum activities, then both cubism and RQM are explicitly local relative to that background. And secondly, I'm going to argue that both of them imply that ultimately space-time must be treated quantum mechanically. And when we do that, we'll find that, in fact, locality is not generally a well-defined concept. So in that sense, I'm going to say that cubism and RQM do admit of ontological models that are as local as possible, granted the quantum nature of space-time. So here we go. The big thing that you need to understand about cubism and relational quantum mechanics for this talk is this issue of fact relativity. So let's go over what that means in each of them. So in cubism, we have these, what I'm calling facts, and I'll call them events also a lot. In cubism, that means measurement outcomes. And the observers, that's a generic term that I'm going to use, which in cubism means some decision-making agent. And the basic postulate in cubism that ties these things together says that a measurement outcome is a personal experience of the agent who performs the measurement. And what the agent experiences really happens for them. So we can take it as an element of reality relative to them. And I'm going to allow, just for the sake of being as general as possible, that one and the same element of reality can be experienced by several agents. And so the upshot of all of this is that the facts or events of cubism, which are measurement outcomes, are therefore relative to the observers of cubism, who are the agents. Pretty straightforward in that respect. And RQM has kind of a different rationale about it, but the conclusion winds up being the same. So in RQM, these facts or events are kind of natural, spontaneous phenomena. They just happen. They call them quantum events. And they occur just whenever two physical systems interact. Okay, and observers in this case are just any physical system. So we can take any one of those systems and that can be an observer. So the basic postulate, the basic postulate that ties these together in RQM is that a quantum event happens relative to the systems involved in the physical interaction. And we can take either one of them to be designated as the observer of that fact or event. And again, these quantum events are supposed to correspond to elements of reality, the building blocks of the relational ontology. So events of one observer may not be events relative to another. And the same element of reality, again, can be a quantum event relative to several observing systems. I see Anna raised a hand. Do you have a question?
Yes, just very brief, to be clear on what you are really meaning with same element of reality, like a same number on a measurement tool. Is this what you mean, or what precisely is
the
same?
Well, the idea is that we want to say that there is something in the ontology, something that actually happens that is a little piece of reality, if you like. So when I say the same element of reality, what I mean is something kind of like you and I might be, let's say, interacting in RQM. We're physical systems and we might be interacting with the same table. You know, we're both sitting at it, you know, and we're interacting with it in different ways. So, but still it's the same table. Uh-oh, I just see the number of hands doubled. That means I didn't answer the question.
I guess now I'm picturing an elephant, but...
Right. One person has the tail, the other the trunk. Was there another hand?
Yes. Martin Green here. The challenge I have is understanding what is meant by a physical system. Because in quantum theory, you know, you only get systems kind of by trying to decompose your total state, and you need, in order to do that, you need some notion of a classical world. So physical systems presume that you have space-time and you have a classical world. So how can you start talking about physical systems before you've built that level?
Okay, well, I'm going to field that one to the end of the talk, because I think any satisfying answer to that will take longer than the talk itself, and probably other people will be able to answer it better than me. But for the purposes of this talk, you can just take it pragmatically to mean whatever we mean when we're talking about it, let's say, at the physics lab or over beers. So use the kind of colloquial physicist meaning of that term, and that'll get us at least through this talk. And I want to throw in a couple more of ingredients that we're going to need from both of these interpretations. So in both of them, observers are supposed to have an associated time orientation. So they have a past and a future. In cubism, that's just boils down to your subjective experience. I mean, past and future is meaningful to you, you know, personally, we know what it means. In RQM, I'm not entirely sure how they justify the the orientation of physical systems from past to future, but probably an argument from thermodynamics would work. You know, thermodynamic arrow of time of the system will define its orientation, for instance. But either way, systems are oriented from their past to their future. And it's going to be very useful to talk about some events as being free actions relative to a given observer. Now, I'm going to use the very most minimal definition of a free action as just some variable that is independent of events outside of its future light cone. So if you like, there's the only things which are correlated with it are in its causal future. So for all practical purposes, you can take it as a variable that has no causes itself within the system that you're considering. In cubism, of course, there's a lot more baggage associated with free actions. They're the voluntary actions of free-willed agents. But in RQM, I guess these are simply the variables that will correspond to things like our choices of measurement basis. You know, if you use RQM to describe a Bell experiment, you know, one of the variables will be which basis do you measure in? And that's considered to be a free action for the purposes of analyzing that experiment. All right, there's several hands up. Someone wanna, if you have a relatively short question, go ahead.
For the definition about free action, for example, in Bohmian mechanics, it's very hard to satisfy this definition. So like, I wonder whether we can just use a more operational definition of free action, that it is empirically independent of anything. Or we can just say free action is anything that scientists think that it's enough for doing experiment, like as a randomized trials for experiment.
So I think in this particular case, we're saved by the fact that in RQM and cubism, differently from Bohmian mechanics, these quantum events or the facts or experiences of cubism, these are all things that are explicitly observable. So they're things we can observe and they're part of the operational description. So this independence condition is actually an operational one, exactly as you are saying. because in cubism and RQM, there are no hidden variables that might be influencing things behind the scenes.
I thought just before you mentioned that in cubism and RQM, you still have some ontology reality.
Yes, but it's not hidden. It's right. It's what you, in the case of cubism, it's what the agents experience. Like it's the things you see in the lab, let's say where the needle is pointing on your instrument. Mm-hmm. And in RQM, it's what happens in a physical interaction, which means, mm-hmm. you know, quantities that are quantifiable things that happen in the lab, you know, the temperature of a heat bath or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thanks.
Jacques, can you just briefly explain why you define it as independent of events outside the future light cone and not dependent only on events in its past? Are you sort of allowing for that you might have correlation between an event and something which is not in its past nor in its future? Because that seems to be that shouldn't be allowed.
There's nothing especially tricky going on here. The intuition is just that if you think of what we normally consider to be a free action, it's like I'm choosing, you know, which basis to measure my particle in. We usually assume that my choice is not determined somehow by something that is, you know, happening at space-like separation from me, or maybe even in my causal past. At least nothing that would be relevant to the outcome of the experiment. So that's all the assumption is meant to achieve. is to capture that intuition. Okay, so it'll be useful in order to help understand better what we mean by locality. I just want to give you this heuristic of three layers of a physical theory. You can think of it in terms of an operational layer, which is, you know, the things that we observe in laboratories, the actions we take, like preparations, measurements, and the probabilities of those things. So this is all, everything that exists kind of at the observable statistical level. Below that, we have the mathematical formalism that we use to make those predictions and to model systems abstractly and do calculations. And then below that, again, we have a formal representation of what we consider to be really going on, as it were, underneath. And the purposes of these different levels are different. You know, at the top, it's about connecting to what we do in the lab. And at the bottom, it's really about trying to explain the observations at the top layer, say, by translating them into a metaphysical worldview, you know, of our universe and our place in it. And I want to point out that you really need to consider a theory in terms of all three layers. And in practice, we do. We just tend to mix them up and sometimes deal with one and sometimes with the other without really thinking about it. But this becomes important when talking about, say, locality. And changing slide. And so if we filter locality through these three categories, we see that there are actually different definitions that we can think about. At the top level, you have operational locality, which is usually called non-signaling, which means, for instance, that observations Y cannot be affected by actions A performed outside its past life code. Formally, they must be statistically independent. And then at the mathematical level, we have this idea of formalism locality, which Lucian Hardy has written about in some of his papers. The idea being that calculations pertaining to any region of space-time employ only mathematical objects associated with that region. And I gave there the example of algebraic quantum field theory, where you use the field algebra defined in some region of space-time. Okay, but then even that's not the same as ontological locality, because these field algebras don't necessarily represent ontological entities. So then again, you can ask, for example, as Bell did in his famous thought experiment, you know, whether an element of reality, not necessarily an observable one, can be affected by actions performed outside its past life code. Okay, just to kind of clarify that these are distinct ways of posing the problem of locality. And in the case of cubism and RQM, we can already answer the first two. So both cubism and RQM are interpretations that are designed, they're constructed to be compatible with the usual Hilbert space formalism, and to conform to the operational predictions of quantum theory. So by construction, these interpretations will satisfy operational locality, so they're non-signaling, and formalism locality, if you formulate quantum theory in a local formalism, which you can do. So the big question is really, do they satisfy ontological locality? And both of them have claimed in the literature that they do, as a direct consequence of the principle of relative facts. So I'm going to dig into that now and see if whether their argument is decisive. So here's how the cubism uses relative facts to justify their locality. They say, what the usual story overlooks is that the coming into existence of a particular measurement outcome is valid only for the agent experiencing that outcome. Although each agent experiences an outcome to their own measurement, they can experience an outcome to the measurement undertaken by the other, only when they receive the other's report. Each of them applies quantum mechanics in the only way in which it can be applied to account for the correlations in two measurement outcomes registered in his or her own individual experience. And as noted above, experiences of a single agent are necessarily time-like separated. The issue of non-locality simply does not arise. And for comparison, here's how RQM does it. They say, if one sticks to a particular observer, a relational beable is nothing but a quantum event. It will not be as absolute as Bell would have expected, because talking about quantum events still requires us to first fix a reference observer. But a beable can still be conceived as an element of reality with respect to the reference observer. Now, given a reference observer, the only physically meaningful beables lie in the past cone of O. Indeed, for O, it is a matter of metaphysical faith to attribute an existence to events beyond the scope of its practical experience, future or space-like separated events. But it is a matter of experimental facts to attribute an existence to events in its past cone. And just in case that went by you all a bit too quickly, I'm going to spell it out. They're both saying essentially the same thing in slightly different words. So here it is in simple logical format. Number one, locality must be understood relative to a given observer, let's say Alice. Two, according to relative facts, relative to Alice, Bob's measurement outcome Y only becomes an element of reality for Alice when she observes it. Since she follows a time-like trajectory through space-time, she can only observe Y in the time-like future of her actions A. Therefore, relative to Alice, the outcome Y is always necessarily in the time-like future of her action A. So ontological locality is upheld relative to Alice, regardless of the correlations between A and Y. Here's a little picture for you. You can see Alice, she takes an action A, and at space-like separation over here, Bob observes some outcome Y. But they're far away from each other, so initially Y, Bob's outcome, is not real for Alice. So she continues living for a while, and at some point in her future, she receives a phone call from Bob telling her the outcome Y. Boom. Now Y is real for Alice. And in Bob's case, well, Y was the first thing that became real for him. He observed, say, a detector clicking. And after a while, he receives a phone call from Alice telling him what action A she took. And boom, A becomes real for Bob. So it's actually an almost childishly simple picture. A and Y become real for Alice and Bob at different points in space-time, such that in each case, they're time-like separated. And some of you might be saying, well, what about, there's something a bit funny with Bob because he's seeing some, you know, measurement outcome Y, and then later he's learning what Alice's action was. And that action is in the future of the outcome. So if these two are correlated, how could he explain that? You know, what if there were even a signal? but the point is that Bob doesn't have to think, you know, just because A is a free action for Alice, it doesn't have to be a free action relative to Bob. So the observers don't have to agree on what the free actions are. I just want to signpost that because it turns out to be important. So from Bob's point of view, if he wants to, he could explain the correlation by saying, well, there's some common cause, let's say, which creates a correlation between this outcome Y and Alice's action. But that means her action is not a free choice from Bob's point of view. Just signposting that. But the general idea is clear, I hope. And if we wanted to do the full Bell experiment, we would have Bob take an action on his end, B, and he gets the outcome Y. And Alice takes her action A and sees an outcome C. And now by the same story, you can see that For Alice, Z, B, and Y are all in the future of her action A, and for Bob, A, Z, and Y are in the future of his action B. Now, I'm betting many of you are not happy with this story, and these are three objections that I can anticipate will come up. A couple of them have come up in the literature. So the first objection is, okay, granted that these events are all time-like separated relative to Alice or relative to Bob, they still need to explain the Bell inequality violations in the joint statistics. So what's the explanation explicitly? And the second objection is, since this argument seems to work for any correlations between A and Y, it seems like it would work just fine for correlations that allow signaling faster than light. And that's a little bit weird, because that seems to be saying that this ontology, you know, this ontological argument doesn't explain why quantum theory forbids faster than light signaling. There seems to be something missing. And this was an argument raised by Cavalcanti in his paper, The View from a Wigner Bubble. And the third objection is actually one that I raised in an earlier criticism of relational quantum mechanics. But actually, you could repurpose the same argument against cubism, ironically. And this argument says that we've been presupposing that Alice and Bob are embedded in some well-defined background space-time. But if distances and times are also the outcomes of quantum mechanical measurements, how do we justify that? So I'll go over the answer to one fairly quickly, and I'll spend most of the time trying to answer the second objection, because it's the most interesting, I think. And then the third one, I'll just make a few comments on it. It's interesting too, but it's a bit beyond the scope of what I'm able to talk about today. So objection one, let's spell out in more detail what the objection is saying. So when Alice and Bob measure two parts of an entangled system, we have as an empirical fact that there's no signaling. Actually, real experimentalists tell me that there are signals and you have to do statistics to get rid of them, but okay, we're theorists here. There's no signaling operationally, and any causal model that can faithfully explain no signaling statistics should not have an explanation that says A causes Y or B causes Z. This is the principle of no fine tuning. And furthermore, Reichenbach's principle of decorrelating explanation says that correlations due to common causes, which is really the only option left to us here, must disappear when we condition on those common causes. And if you put these things together, that turns out to imply Bell inequalities. This is also known as the causal version of Bell's theorem. See Wood and Speckens. Very nice paper from 2012. And it's nice because it allows you to formulate Bell's theorem without even worrying about space-like separation at all. You don't even have to know what it means to be space-like separated to formulate this Bell's theorem in this way. So how can we explain then Bell inequality violation with this picture? We have two options. The first option is that we could reject the principle of no fine tuning. So I won't go into details of what that would look like, but basically we could say, well, from Alice's point of view, she just declares that there is a cause, from her actions causing, Bob's outcome Y. And Bob can say that his action has a causal influence on Alice's outcome on her side. And that requires fine tuning to explain why it doesn't lead to faster than light signaling. But this isn't really going to be a popular option with either the cubists or relationalists. So let me talk about their preferred option, which is simply to reject the assumption of decorrelating explanation, also known as the factorization principle. So normally this principle is justified by assuming that correlations can be modeled in terms of some underlying stochastic hidden variables that give rise to the correlations. But this hypothesis is anyway rejected by cubism and RQM. So they're not really compelled to assume that correlations factorize on their common causes. And if you want to see more details about this option to Bell's theorem, I recommend checking out Wiseman and Cavalcanti's paper, Causarum Investigatio. But if we take this option, we kind of create a new problem for ourselves, which is how to explain why quantum correlations stop at Cyrilson's bound and don't get even stronger. The nice thing about decorrelating explanation is it strongly constrains our correlations. So when we don't have it, we need something else to constrain the correlations to the quantum bounds. But RQM and cubism do both have active programs to try to answer that question. So they have reconstruction programs to derive the Hilbert space formalism from information theoretic axioms. And in principle, if you can derive the Hilbert space formalism, you can also derive the bounds on the correlations, quantum correlations. So that would be a kind of independent way of explaining, the Cyrilson bound and so on that doesn't refer to any kind of factorization principle. So the point really is that in response to the top objection, there are options for explaining Bell inequality violations in this picture. That's not really the most interesting issue. More interesting, I think, is how to explain no signaling. So the whole point of having a local ontological model, you would think, is that when you put probabilities on top of it, those probabilities will turn out to forbid faster than light signaling. And yet, as we've seen, it seems to be operationally that signaling is perfectly compatible with this ontology of relative facts. No matter what correlations there are between Alice's action and Bob's outcome, no matter how far apart they are in space, Alice can always claim that A is the cause of Y, and Bob can claim that Y is the cause of A without violating this notion of ontological locality that RQM and cubism have put forward. But this is still kind of vague, so let me try to make it more precise. So I'm going to get into a somewhat detailed definition here. Bear with me, there will be a picture after the slide. So let me define a perspectival ontological model as a set of observers, a set of events, and for each observer, the following elements. Okay, each observer has a subset of events that represent the events that happen relative to that observer. And of those events, another subset represents the events that they consider to be free actions relative to that observer. And then we're going to have a mapping that takes the events from any observer and maps them onto their coordinates in Minkowski spacetime, where the coordinates of that event for that observer represent the spacetime location at which that event became real for that observer. And finally, we're going to need some rules constraining how the observer should assign probabilities to their events, given their relative structure in this ontology. And that's where our ideas of locality will come in. So to put all of that in a pretty picture, on the left here, here's my set of all events. But we can't think of the set of all events as describing events that are all simultaneously real, because that would be a God's eye point of view. What we want to do is consider subsets of events and say this subset of events is real relative to this observer, the red guy. And this subset is real relative to the blue observer, and so on. Okay. And then within each of these subsets of events, so the events real to the red man, he's going to select a subset of events which are free actions for him. So that will have some statistical requirements going with that, that these will have to be free, independent of anything outside their future light cone. Okay. And finally, these events have to be mapped somehow into Minkowski space-time. So what we're going to do is each observer will have their own map. The red man has C1, and the blue man has C2. And this map tells you which space-time coordinates they assign to each of their events. In this diagram, I have an event here, which is an event for both of them, but they each map it to different points in space-time, okay, which is allowed by this ontology. And I just want to signpost a couple of things about this picture. So you saw that we're assuming there's a single map of space-time. Okay, we're just using a single manifold to map everybody's coordinates into there. And the third objection that I mentioned, it kind of attacks that assumption. But for the moment, we're going to assume that's unproblematic. And the kind of operational content of that assumption is that we're assuming that no observer is considered to be in a superposition of different space-time locations relative to the other observers. So they can all kind of talk to each other, locate each other in space-time and say, hey, where are you right now in, you know, this particular reference frame? What are your coordinates? And they all can come to some kind of conventional labeling of their own world lines in the single space-time manifold. And I just want to make sure that you notice that given a single event, because of this, the fact that the same event can happen at different places and times relative to different observers, the notion of locality is not going to be well defined. Okay. So let's talk about that. The problem is which of the many space-time coordinates assigned by observers to a given event should we use in when we define things like light cones and world lines? Okay, we have basically two options, at least two that immediately come to mind. One is that we can define locality for each observer separately using the coordinates that they that represent when those events occurred for that observer. So I'm going to call this perspectival locality because we're basically using the space-time coordinates for a given observer to define light cone structure and so on. And that's implicitly what RQM and cubism were doing in those quotes that I showed you earlier. But the second option that I'm going to propose is that we define locality relative to a collective protocol for assigning a single coordinate to each event. And I'll call that global locality. So let me go over each of these options and see how they might work. In perspectival locality, we're going to say that it's satisfied if the coordinates of any event relative to an observer lie along their world line. And the probability of any free action has to be independent of events in the past of the action. And this is really just a formalization of what I described earlier. So this principle of relative facts together with the definition of free actions basically implies perspectival locality. And as cubism and RQM both argued in those quotes, I showed you, events only happen relative to an observer when the observer encounters them physically, like either experiencing them in cubism or interacting with them. So they have to happen along its world line. And of course, the world lines are oriented from past to future. And the actions are independent of the events that happen in their past. So if we build if we use one of these perspectival ontological models for cubism or RQM, it must be perspectively local in this sense. But now, of course, we can prove fairly rigorously that it's still compatible with fast and light signaling. I think, made that point pretty clearly. Even if A and Y have space-like separated coordinates in the Minkowski space-time, if you consider where they happen relative to Alice or Bob, they're going to be time-like separated. So we can satisfy perspectival locality even when there really is a signal going from A to Y across a space-like distance. So I just wanted to really hammer this home, because this is a reason not to be satisfied with perspectival locality, because it's not a strong enough locality criterion to really explain why our statistics has to be non-signaling. So that's why I want to define the stronger version of global locality. So we need to define a collective protocol. So we have these different observers here, and they each assign the same event E different coordinates. Okay, so how do we, So how do we assign a single global space-time coordinate to these three coordinates that are all associated to the same event E? Well, how about we do the following? We just choose an orientation of the space-time, you know, a future past direction. And then we consider what is the future pointing light cone that most tightly contains these events. Okay, that should be uniquely defined. So we put that there, just touching the green event here. And that's as good as we can get while including all these coordinates. And then we're going to look at the vertex of that light cone and call the coordinates of that vertex the global coordinates of the event E. So even though E is actually experienced by observers at all these different points, we can still assign a unique abstract set of coordinates using this protocol. And all the observers, let's assume they can communicate to each other, well, you know, where and when did E happen for you? And they can say, tell each other their coordinates, and then they can all sit down and work out where this vertex has to be. So they can all agree what the global coordinates of the event E should be. I wanted to just mention that just for fun, I put this red man upside down because it is possible that the orientations of the observer's world lines might be pointing in different directions. A priori, I haven't said anything to forbid that. So when they get together to agree on a convention, the convention of the future direction of the total space-time might not necessarily agree with one of their personal experiences or, you know, with the thermodynamically defined arrow of time of one of these observers. But that's just a side comment. The main interesting point I want to make is that if our perspectival ontological model satisfies a condition of global locality, then we can say some stronger things about. So the definition of what I'm calling global locality is that the global coordinates of any event for a given observer have to be independent of all free actions whose global coordinates lie outside the past light cone of that event. And every free action for that observer has to be statistically independent of all events whose invariant, sorry, that should be global coordinates. I switched around the terminology a bit, whose global coordinates lie outside the future light cone of the action A. So it's really quite similar to perspectival locality, but I'm switching global coordinates instead of using the observer's personal coordinates. And then I believe that these results can be established, which means I've done it in my notebook, but there might be errors in it, so they could turn out to be wrong. But you heard it here first. So I believe that if a perspectival ontological model satisfies this condition, then you can show that all the observers' individual past future orientations have to be lined up with the global orientation that they chose, as you know, that's the convention for this definition. And secondly, if it satisfies both perspectival locality and global locality, then it must be non-signaling. I believe that's the case. I won't try to prove it to you now because we're just out of time almost, and I'm not sure I would succeed. I wanted to So let me just conclude that by saying that I believe that they can explain why quantum theory is operationally non-signaling, as long as we define locality as being perspectively and globally local in my definition of a perspectival ontological model. I'm not 100% sure that either RQM or cubism would endorse this ontological model that I've proposed. I can already imagine objections, but I think it does drive the point home that at least it might be possible to make the claim of locality explicit. Let me talk finally just a little bit about this issue in objection three. So this assumption that all the observers can talk to each other and decide where they are in space-time relative to each other, it's a fairly strong assumption because we know that even though we can do it in practice, that's because Wigner-Friend experiments are not very commonplace. But if they were, we might have the following problem. Suppose that Wigner puts his friend into a superposition of measuring an atom and getting spin up or measuring and getting spin down. So the usual Wigner-Friend. But let's add an extra twist on it and say that when the outcome is spin up, the friend is on the left side of the laboratory at position xt away from Wigner. And when the spin is down, they're at the other side of the laboratory, so displaced by a distance of L. And now we have the issue that Wigner and the friend, who I named Fran, they disagree about where Fran's world line, hence her light cones and everything, are located. Because for Wigner, Fran's world line doesn't have a definite location. It's in a superposition. And that means we can't really use all of that formal structure that I defined in answering objection number two, because now it's not even clear what that manifold of events would be that we're mapping all the observers into. It seems almost as if we would need to have different kind of space-time patches, one for Wigner and one for Fran, such that within each patch, the relative coordinates of the observers in that patch are well-defined. But between the two patches, maybe they're not well-defined. And so the issue is, how do we define locality in the setting? And the idea would be that maybe we can generalize the definition of the ontological model to include a patch-like structure in which only subsets of observers share the same space-time map. So maybe between the Wigners, they can use all of that formal technology that I defined amongst themselves and therefore define locality within Wigner's bubble. And Fran, you know, all the Frans and their friends can define locality relative to their bubble, but we cannot give a meaningful definition of locality for events between the two bubbles. In that case, we can't really say whether the ontology is local or non-local. The terms just wouldn't be meaningful because we don't have an unambiguous notion of world line, light cone, and so on. But this is kind of, you know, this whole talk was kind of speculating ahead of work that hasn't been fully done yet. I'm sure that when Chris watches the recording of this talk, he'll be like, where is this stuff coming from? Because I haven't even talked about this with the other cubists yet. I'm really curious to know how they react. And this here is speculating even beyond speculation. So I'm just going to stop there. I'll conclude by saying that I do think it's possible to define a framework of perspectival ontological models which are consistent with relative facts and so can be consistent with cubism or RQM. And within these models, I think we can give mathematical definitions of locality that allow us to define explicitly local ontological models for these interpretations, given a background space-time assumption. And that would be nice because then we can say that we finally explain Bell inequality violations and non-signaling without having to give up on ontological locality. The big price to pay, of course, is that facts are relative in these ontologies. So it's up to you to decide if that's cool. Thank you.
I think thanks a lot for the talk, Jacques. I guess I will chair or if you want to chair yourself as you've been doing, you may as well, but I can also tell people to ask the questions.
I prefer it if you're the one who selects people.
Perfect, yeah. Okay, I will just take them in the order that they appear. So Ding, you can ask your question.
Thanks, Philip, and thanks, Jack, for the nice talk. So I'm wondering what Carlo Rovelli would say to you, I'm guessing, this is my guess, about how to define locality in RQAM. I guess he would refer to the general boundary formalism by Eco, which dates back to Dirac in his first paper on the path integral. So there you have what you might call a formalism locality there. You have some topological regions of space-time. You don't need to specify a gravitational configuration, but you have a notion of what's near to each other as topological regions, and what are adjacent to each other. And there you can define your quantum theory by, for example, a path integral, and you have a notion of locality because your path integral configurations live in these regions and you know which one is next to each other, which one is not next to each other. So I wonder, what would your response be if Carlo says we already have a good definition of locality in RQAM?
Gee, that's a tough one. We're talking about a hypothetical conversation in which I have to try to imagine.
You can just take the words from me. That's my response. I think there is a good definition of locality already in RQAM.
It sounds like what you're describing is closer to what I was calling formalism locality. So I guess you could reformulate this, the question you're putting to me as, why can't we just take, let's say, a mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics that satisfies formalism locality and just kind of directly interpret its mathematical objects as being ontologically real? And would that generate an ontological model that's satisfactory? I don't know if that's how you would, if you'd agree with that reformulation. I would first maybe ask
why you want some ontological notion of locality at all. What's the motivation? The motivation you mentioned is there's an objection to explain no signaling. Is that the motivation for ontological locality?
It's more than that. That's one of the pieces of it. But the whole point of an, you even get more radical people who say, well, we know how to use quantum mechanics in the lab. You know, we know the operational stuff and Hilbert spaces. So what more do you need? Who needs to talk about what's really going on underneath? I think there's only one really good answer to that, which is that if you don't explain a phenomenon in terms of what's going on underneath, so to speak, it's very difficult to expand your theorizing to new regimes where you haven't got experiments yet. So if you wanted to formulate a theory of quantum gravity, say, or what would happen inside a black hole, ontological models are where we take inspiration, you know, because they're suggestive beyond just the scope of what has been done before. Different interpretations will inspire different approaches to quantum gravity if we ever get around to pushing them that far.
My response would be, I do have an ontology for both matter and gravity. They're quantum. For matter, I have the standard model. There are these fields These are my ontology for matter, degrees of freedom. For gravity, I have several models, candidate models. I do a gravitational path integral. I can choose a lot of different kinds of variables, causal sets, spin foams, spatial quantum gravity, causal dynamic triangulation. I have all these ontological bases for my theory of quantum gravity. And then these all obey the notion of locality I just mentioned. So it's not very clear to me what you okay, ask beyond it.
My intuition is that it would, I'm skeptical that the ontological models you describe would satisfy my criterion for what it means to be local, but I don't think we could sort that out in any quick time frame. Maybe we should postpone that discussion and get other people's questions in while there's still time.
Yeah, all right. So Manu, you can ask your question.
Yes, thanks for the wonderful talk. My question was about the prescription to ascribe global locality, in which you said you find a maximal a light cone that restricts all the say the points on the Minkowski space, which are events for which are the same event for different observers. But it could be possible, means by the picture you drew, that there could be two events for which are say time-like separated for one observer, but through this prescription will become space-like separated. Means if you assume, say, the blue observer, and there is the point, the event that is the blue dot, and then if you observe a point which is outside this, say, the light cone, but which is time-like separated from this blue dot, and if you consider those, you consider all the points which are correspond to that event for all the observers, there could be a chance that the minimal light cone that you have would, say, converge to a point which is space-like separated from, say, the event here. Do you see that as a possibility?
You're asking whether there could be a situation where the global coordinate of the event is space-like separated from all the coordinates of the of where the event is actually observed. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, my question is that means if you would have two events, which is for and observed by say the blue observer, which on the Minkowski space mapped here would be time-like separated, but through this prescription of global coordinate that you ascribe, whether the global coordinates of both the two events would be space-like separated. Could that be a possibility? Because
right, whether two events could be time-like separated for an observer,
mm-hmm. And but for in the
relative
global
to an observer, but space-like. Gee, I don't know. I don't have intuitively that seems a bit strange to me, but I can't think of any obvious reason to forbid it. I'd have to think about that.
Sorry if I jump in, but isn't this exactly what happens when you're considering the Bell experiment, right? Alice has two events that are time-like separated for her, but in the global map, they will be space-like separated.
Yeah, like here. So Alice has two events that are time-like. Oh yeah, that is right, because here B for Alice is time-like separated from A.
Right.
But if you look at, so B presumably here, the global event for B would be located here, and the global event for A would be located here. So they'd be space-like. Yeah, nice, thanks. You answered the question. The answer is yes.
Yeah, thank you.
So since I stole the position, thanks for this talk. I still haven't gotten my head around to satisfying the get to this discussion about locality within both RQM and cubism. I think at the level of operation, like at the level of humans, they're basically the same. Then there's some disagreement about free will, but in terms of kind of the ontologies, I don't know how different they are in the end when we talk about humans. So I was curious about your solution because, so if I understand, I don't know if I understood perfectly. You're saying that asking for both the perspectival locality and the global locality solves, explains the not bell, but the no signaling. Is this the case? Is it?
Yeah, so I convinced myself after scribbling on my notebook for about 2 hours yesterday that this global locality condition and the perspectival locality are sufficient to imply operational no signaling. That doesn't in itself tell you what the bounds on your correlations will be. So this might be true for a generalized probabilistic theory, which can violate the Cyrillson bound, for instance. It would be interesting to see if one can formulate GPTs on this kind of ontology.
Yeah, but and why isn't global locality sufficient on its own for no signaling?
I don't know if it is. It when I was trying to prove it, I couldn't see how to do it without using perspectival locality as well, but maybe there is a way. It's not clear to me what the relationship is between these two definitions yet. I don't know if one of them implies the other.
No, but it's interesting because global locality then becomes sort of constraint on how much people can agree, essentially. And that enforces no signaling within your, like within a single observer's correlations. Asking for global locality means that there is still no signaling between Alice's reaction and when she receives Bob. Like she cannot influence this Bob thing because they want, like it's global locality kind of enforces like a coherence between hers and Bob's story somehow.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that if you only have one observer in the universe, that you,
then you don't have to worry about
your ontology, then they're equivalent. Then global locality reduces to perspectival locality. But so global locality definitely is somehow like a coherence condition between multiple observers. Yeah, and it's entirely possible that if you add an observer and include their coordinates, you'll have to revise the global coordinates of all the events. So yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks.
Okay. We have other questions. So, Charlie.
Hi. Thanks for the nice talk. I was wondering what you can do if, given this set of events, that the global coordinate you want to define doesn't actually exist. Like, what if they're so far separated that this minimal light cone intersects the Big Bang or something, and suddenly you can't define this global coordinate? Like, what would that do to global locality?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. You even forget the Big Bang. You could say, what if it's inside a black hole, for example? Or, I mean, in a sense, maybe it won't matter that much because, as I mentioned here somewhere, the global coordinate of an event is a purely abstract construction, so it doesn't have to correspond to a location where something actually happens relative to any observer.
But before the Big Bang, it's not even a location. So it's not just a problem it's not something to happen, but it's not even a location you could talk about.
You could maybe, though, just embed your events in a bigger space-time that in which the Big Bang happened longer ago. I mean, maybe that's a contrived solution, but I'm not certain there would be a fundamental problem there. Maybe.
I guess I'm just confused then what your global coordinates are doing if they don't even need to live in the space-time that we're considering.
I guess you can think of them as a kind of as a stand-in for the information that's contained in the actual coordinates. It's kind of like the center of mass in a way. It's something that you calculate from a bunch of things that, you know, have a kind of material existence, but it itself isn't something that's really tangible. It has more of a symbolic function. But, you know, you could question like, well, why is it well motivated to define locality in terms of those things if they're so abstract? That's a good point. I don't have a good answer to that.
And we also have a question by David.
Hi, Jacques. Thanks for the nice talk. So to me, the deepest lesson we can take from Bell's theorem isn't specifically about locality in and of itself, but rather about the possibility of finding a compelling causal explanation of quantum correlations, as you know, the Wood and Speckens paper argued. So I'm wondering, even if cubism or relativistic quantum mechanics managed to derive the Hilbert space structure or some Cyrilson-like bounds from information theoretic principles, I don't see how that would help provide any sort of causal explanation of what's going on. So, you know, for example, would there be an analog of Reichenbach's principle or some way to answer counterfactual questions? Are these the kind of questions that cubism or relativistic quantum mechanics is interested in, or is it just not an important mode of description for these programs? So for me personally, it's kind of the essence of realism, but I feel like what you described as the possible types of explanations that they're searching for didn't feel to me like it had the flavor of a causal modeling kind of a explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely you're right to not be satisfied with it if that's your conception of, you know, what is really the spirit of finding an explanation for correlations. You know, one of the, you could say, like, the spirit of Reichenbach's principle says that the bounds on correlations somehow should come from the underlying causal structure. That would be one way to make, I think, the argument that you're putting forward here. And the strategy that cubism and RQM use doesn't agree with that. They're kind of saying, no, the constraints on correlations come from elsewhere entirely. It's not to do with how things are arranged in space-time. That's not what gives you the constraints on the correlations. It's something, some set of information theoretic principles about doing measurements on two subsystems of a larger system, but without necessarily paying attention to how it's causally connected, or at least the causal aspect is incidental to that. And the fundamental constraints come from some other principles. Of course, RQM and cubism have different opinions as to what those principles are. But yeah, definitely, yeah, it is a complete rejection of this kind of spirit of Reichenbach's principle in that respect.
Right, and also it seems of the spirit of classical causal modeling. Like, it seems, mm-hmm. at least that was kind of the impression I got from your talk, was that the specific kind of, there didn't seem to be kind of a hypothesized causal DAG, for example. It was kind of... that was just, you don't have one yet, but you'd hope to find one. But I feel like the kind of the DAG structure of classical causal models, the kind of picking a graph, and that's the first step of any, you know, attempted
causal reasoning. I didn't want to imply that RQM and cubism are not compatible with, let's say, these quantum causal models, or you could take like the process formalism of Bob Koch with his quantum picturalism diagrams, or you could take networks of quantum channels and use that as a kind of representation of quantum causal structure. And there you would also be giving up on decorrelating explanation. But I guess, RQM and cubism are fine with that kind of thing. But I would just point out that in all of those kind of models, even though they contain causal structure as a structure, it's not really doing much work in setting the bounds on the correlations, because you can put GPTs on the same causal structure and get different bounds, you see. So you've kind of lost the essential connection that decorrelating explanation kind of ties causal structure very tightly to the bounds on correlations. Whereas once we consider generalized, say, quantum networks, quantum processes, we've kind of given up on that close tie. You know, you could just as well put a GPT on there. I don't know if that was a coherent answer. Sorry.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks.
Rob?
Yeah, thanks, Philip. So Jacques, I wanted to ask a very kind of basic question about at the start of your talk, when you're discussing what RQM and Cubism had in common, you said something like, you know, that the ontology was dependent on the perspective of the observer. I think it was your like point number one in both your...
Oh yeah, that's the thing I keep calling relative facts.
Right. So that surprised me a bit. So back in May, when you started on this, I got an email from Chris Fuchs asking for my take on RQM. I think he might've shared that with you, but I was criticizing RQM based on the perspectival nature of facts. And my impression was that Chris was kind of on board with that. So let me just sort of tell you how I see it, which is that if you think the quantum state is epistemic, then, you know, like one of the advantages of doing so is that the things that can be, you know, observer dependent become knowledge of reality, not reality itself. So if your goal is to unscramble James's omelet, it's a pretty good bet that anytime you find something that's observer dependent, you say, oh, well, that's going to be the knowledge stuff, the stuff that's observer dependent. That's the beauty of allowing observer's knowledge into the, you know, the conceptual scheme of your theory. And so there's certain kinds of perspectivalism, like in relativity, where say the length of an object is dependent on the perspective, but it's not a true perspectivalism in the sense that, you know, ultimately there's the world tube of the system, which is independent of the observers. And we understand different observers' measurements in terms of the fact that they're looking at different slices of that same world tube. So they're actually describing different things, but there is a picture that fits all of their perspectives together. Whereas RQM strikes me as a more thoroughgoing perspectivalism, which says, no, there is no single picture that fits all the perspectives together. There just really is perspective dependence. You know, facts are perspective dependent. Which, yeah, in my mind, that's not unscrambling James's omelet. And my impression was that Chris Fuchs, you know, thought that as well. And so my impression was that...
Chris is totally on board with what you just said about RQM, I'm pretty sure.
but you seem to characterize cubism as also allowing facts to be perspective dependent. And that's what I thought Chris didn't like about RQM. So would Chris endorse your characterization of cubism as having... you know, facts that are dependent on observers?
I think he would. I'd give it a 90% certainty. I would bet 90 cents on the dollar that he would endorse that.
Yeah, I think definitely as well.
I mean, to be fair, something that I'm doing here that cubists normally never do is make a connection between measurement outcomes, which cubists say are equal to agents' experiences, and what I'm calling elements of reality. So that's a pretty, from a cubist point of view, that's a risky move, I think, because as soon as you do that, you're gonna have to say a whole lot of other things that might get you in trouble. Still, I think that that's where cubism is trying to get to, or at least that's where I wanna take it to. So I can understand being cautious about it, but I do think it's consistent with the cubist spirit, as I understand it.
Okay, and then what about you? Do you are you sympathetic to this criticism I just articulated that you know both RQM and cubism, if it subscribes to that, you know, ought not to make reality perspective dependent? You know, because anytime something's perspective dependent, I claim, you know, that's an indication, that's a smoking gun, that it's about knowledge, not about reality. So do you reject that?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really thought about it before in the terms that you articulated, like that the task of separating the omelet, as you say, like the great thing about, you know, thinking about it epistemically is that all the things that seem to be observer dependent, we can put down their dependence as being just due to epistemic perspectives, you know, different knowledge, let's say. But I have to say that for me, that wasn't really, I've never thought about that as being the main point. For me, it was more just really about understanding what are the ingredients, like what are the statements that we can confidently make about the way reality is. And that might involve some kind of observer dependency. You know, for me, reality is not per definition observer independent. So I've for a long time distinguished between the concept of objectivity and reality. For me, those are kind of independent concepts. Reality may or may not be objective. Objectivity is something that science strives for. And even in a reality which is not objective, such as the one described here, we still want to strive towards identifying objective concepts because that's what science does. But, you know, I don't kind of tie reality to the necessity of objectivity.
Okay, thanks.
Do we have other questions? We have a comment from
I just threw a quote from a recent paper from Fuchs about Rob's question about what he thinks. So as I understand it, it's kind of essential to the cubist response to like Frauschiger-Renner and these extended Wigner's friend scenarios. It's essential that there's no sort of global picture, but they say, you know, measurement outcomes are personal and fundamentally personal in a way that like is not reducible to a global picture.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, you know what, I revise it up to 95% confidence that Chris would agree with that.
Then maybe I will ask you a question since we still have like 5 minutes. So your description seemed to assume that like either observers or systems have some kind of identity over time, right? And that they're events or facts also preserve their reality over time. So that when you're at a later time along the world line, the stuff that happened in the past is still an element of reality. And I'm wondering how you can justify that, or is it, would there be a way to justify that in an ontology that takes observers or systems as primitive, right? Because in other types of ontology, maybe you would have these things to be like emergent concepts, and then you could explain things maybe in a different way. But here it seems to be like pre-assumed that systems keep their identity over time, even though we should expect that in some scenarios they don't, right? I mean, stuff breaks.
I mean, you know, it's true that practically speaking, nothing keeps its identity over time for very long. You know, neither you nor I, nor any scientist, not even atoms of pure iron, you know, like everything comes and goes out of the void. But so I don't see this assumption as being, it's an idealization, but I don't think it's an essential one for this formalism. I'm sure one could generalize this to, for instance, it's often natural to think about observers as terminating at some final event so that you can talk about everything in their past light cone that could have possibly reached them. And also as beginning at some event, so you can really confine them to a causal diamond in space-time, and that kind of encapsulates the whole existence of that observer. And then every system or observer has a finite extent in space and time, which is a pretty practical, natural assumption. Yeah, there's no reason why you couldn't do that here. It's really just more for convenience that I talked about observers who are long-lived, you know, long enough to see a few different things before they disappear. But I guess you could break up an observer into a bunch of different, like, you could make everything essentially point-like and make an observer just a chain of point-like events that have some special relationship to each other. Not sure what that would be, though. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where my question was going. Like, so the let's say in the absence of a physical principle that allows you to tell like precisely when does this observer start, or maybe I can split the word line and start calling these two different observers, then in the limit, each observer is only at a single time, and then somehow, well, at least the perspectival locality becomes completely trivial, no, because it's about single point. But I suppose that the other one is still remains. So
it's probably worth pointing out that Cubism and RQM would have very different ways of doing that, because in Cubism, an observer basically has to satisfy the conditions of being a decision-making agent. So they have to kind of be able to make free choices, you know, reason about things. Presumably they have a memory, you know. So as long as those conditions hold true, and as long as the observer kind of has a certain internal coherence between their own past and future, like that their memories make sense to them and they say, yep, those are my memories, not somebody else's that were transplanted into me, you know, a kind of self-identification across time, you have a cubist agent. But in RQM, you'd be looking at physical properties of a system. So maybe you'd want to have a thermodynamic arrow and certain properties that remain fixed over time, like its mass and volume or something, you know. But I guess there'd be various ways to do it.
Thanks. So I can ask again if there's other questions. Otherwise, let's thank Jacques again for this nice talk. It was very enjoyable.
Thanks for having me.
And see you in person at some point, hopefully, as well.
Let's hope. All right.
Thanks, Jacques.
Okay, bye everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.